Hi, welcome to Door County Gardening. I'm your host, Brett Hansen, and this week we're discussing how climate change is changing gardening in Door County. Before we begin, I want to remind you that I do not consider myself an expert on any gardening topics, but I promise to always strive to share the best information I can, and will always try to invite more knowledgeable people onto the show whenever possible. But at the same time, I agree with the motto, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. So the goal today is a very good introductory discussion on some of the most important climate change topics for Door County gardeners and naturalists. Please visit this blog post on Door County Gardening for a transcript, links, or to see my research sources and other helpful information. So let's get started. The first issue is the changing growing seasons. Warming temperatures have clearly extended the growing season. We all know this, allowing gardeners to plant earlier in the spring and harvest later in the fall. This also allows us to plant new varieties that have become viable in this region due to this shift in temperature and humidity levels. Now we can see this statistically in the 2023 hardiness zones map released by the USDA. They've updated their plant hardiness zone map for the first time since 2012, and it is now an essential tool for gardeners and growers to determine all kinds of things, like plant viability by location and growing season and things like that. It's very easy to find online. Just put in hardiness zones map, and you'll get to the website. It'll also be linked on the show notes for this episode. And then you just insert your zip code at the top. Now, the first improvement is in enhancements in accuracy. It was developed in collaboration with Oregon State University's PRISM Climate Group. So the 2023 map offers improved accuracy and detail over previous versions. For example, we can clearly see now that Green Bay has moved into a Zone 5B. And really surprising to me as someone who grew up in Michigan, most of Lower Michigan is 6A, with a little 6B in the far southeast. One other thing I found fascinating by exploring the map is that here in Door County, you know, we're 5B, but we have a small little section of 6A, and I call it the little 6A square. It's just north of where I live. It's little, but it's there. And I'll mention more on that later. The second improvement is the interactive online access and features. Previous maps were accessible online, but this one features an interactive GIS-based format, Geographic Information System, and has been expanded to include a, quote, tips for growers section. Now, the GIS is kind of like a four-dimensional map or data source. And when I first read about it, I thought, oh, this is going to be really cool because we'll be able to go to the map and go to a spot, and it'll give us some of that four-dimensional information. But I realized that basically it used that four-dimensional information or that type of information to determine zones, but it doesn't provide it through the online feature. But it's still very cool. I'll include a diagram with explanations about GIS on the show notes as well. So we can download now the maps just like we could before, but now they're much finer and you can focus in more specifically. So they're not just PDFs. They'll ultimately be a PDF, but you can zoom in more. The third improvement is in the data and methodology they used. It's now based on a 30-year averages of minimum winter temperatures and data from over 13,000 weather stations. And this offers finer resolution, especially for rural places, like the majority of Alaska. The next improvement is in usage and impact. This map is a critical tool for approximately 80 million American gardeners and growers, as well as scientific researchers. So this new map now is so accurate that scientists are using it. And also crop insurance adjusters and crop insurance standards people, they're using these maps or this map to make important decisions that affect financial results. Finally, The zonal adjustments and climate insights clearly show that some areas are becoming warmer zones. Now, the USDA doesn't directly attribute these changes to global climate change, and we have to assume that that's a political decision. But common sense allows us to add this to the mountains of other data that shows that climate change is leading to warmer areas, and that affects gardeners enormously. Now, the second dramatic shift due to climate change is increased pest and disease pressure. The milder winters and longer growing seasons have led to the rise of new pests and diseases previously uncommon in the Midwest, and this is affecting both native and cultivated plants. But we don't need anyone to tell this to us either. The spread and intensity of pests and diseases in the Midwest has been impacting gardening and agriculture for a while. The increased temperatures and changes in precipitation patterns are two main drivers of this shift. They facilitate the growth and distribution of new, clearly different pest species by providing a warmer and more humid environment for them. However, extreme levels of temperature and precipitation can also hinder some pest species by destroying their eggs and larvae. So it's not as simple as it might seem, like just more pests. This complex interaction explains why many pests are migrating from tropical areas to more temperate areas. They're seeking optimal conditions for growth as the regions warm up, but not too much, and they're not too dry. Many of the areas that they're migrating away from are becoming drier and more arid. Now, my bee club, the Door County Beekeeping Club, recently invited a crops consultant who advises farmers, including the big consortiums, on when and what to spray for the pests and for overall crop health. His name is Mark, and he told us that they're seeing different pests and seeing them earlier than before. And we all know that farming and gardening is already hard enough, so this is something else that we have to deal with. Research highlights the movement of these crop pests and diseases toward the Earth's poles, away from the equator, at an average of about 3 kilometers a year since 1960, as global temperatures have risen faster. So that means that the pests and diseases of northern Illinois are now regularly our problem too. I didn't find any data yet, but I can't help but wonder if the emerald ash borer didn't accelerate its devastation of so many of our trees because of these better conditions. I did read that diseases such as tar spot, a fungal disease causing significant yield losses in maize and corn, were detected in the U.S. for the first time in 2015, illustrating the shift of typically tropical diseases into more temperate zones. And logic suggests that it will continue to migrate north. Other pests and pathogens, like the southern pine beetle and wheat rusts, are also expanding their geographical range in response to climate change, posing new challenges for Midwest agriculture. Mark told us about some farmers who lost their wheat crop due to a wheat worm. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. And that surprised them because it happened really early in the season, just last year. And now it was especially sad for us because they were sitting in our bee meeting. They're members of our bee club, wonderful beekeepers, and it was sad to hear about their loss. So we can clearly see the effects of these shifts in our community. Fortunately, they'll be more prepared this next year, and they'll keep a closer eye on it. So we just don't really know exactly what this will lead to. It's a very complex scenario. For example, changes in CO2 levels can make plants more palatable to some pests, such as aphids, by increasing the soluble carbohydrates in the plant's phloem tissue. So I can't help but wonder, is this why the Japanese beetles devoured my roses last year? I mean, more than any year before? I tried to manage the problem the way I did the year before, but one day it was as if they just exploded and they just took over. I mean, I had the bags, I was squashing them with my gloved hands and putting them in soapy water. And for a while, it looked like I was going to stay ahead of them because I really don't want to use pesticides. But then one day, they were everywhere. It was just too much. So I have to wonder, was it higher CO2 levels? I don't know, because this is not uniformly beneficial to all pests. as some plants may allocate increased carbon towards the production of secondary metabolites that deter pests. And it's complicated. All I know for sure is I need to be more informed before my roses start flowering this year. We should take proactive measures to manage the problem and maintain the health and productivity of gardens and crops in the region as soon as possible, especially if we really care for these particular plants. It would be so much easier if we just knew what was coming. You know, the old saying, the devil you know is better than the one you don't. Well, it looks like we won't know quite a few of the problems that are coming our way, so we're going to have to be flexible and be ready to learn as quickly as we can. The next issue is water level changes. Lake Michigan has always fluctuated, but we've seen rapid changes in precipitation patterns and increased evaporation rates in recent years. This is leading to fluctuating water levels that can affect garden planting, waterfront properties, flooding one year, and severely dry conditions the next, which is, in my opinion, what's happened over the last few years. Climate change is leading to warmer and wetter conditions in the Great Lakes region, but its effects on water levels are complex and uncertain. Water levels are influenced by a combination of precipitation, evaporation, and runoff from surrounding lands. And the Great Lakes have seen periods of both record high and record low water levels in recent years. For instance, after a period of low water levels from 1998 to 2013, Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes experienced rapid rises to record highs between 2017 and 2020, driven by high precipitation and below average evaporation. Now, I am particularly confused on this topic because I am looking at, you know, Green Bay right here on the edge of Sturgeon Bay at what looked to me like extremely low water levels and beaches that are longer at Sunset Park than I think I've ever seen them. And Little Lake is strangely low. And yet, when I looked for the data online based on the government websites, I found that they're stating that water levels are actually higher. I heard a fisherman talking about how the lake levels were 18 inches low, which seems surprising. And I looked that up, and I don't think that's accurate, but the fishermen think the water's really low. It looks really low, and yet the USDA website says that the water level of Lake Michigan, as of March 15th, is reported to be 578.74 feet above chart datum, which is approximately 15 inches above the chart datum for Lake Michigan Huron. This level represents a 1-inch decrease from the previous year at the same time and is 3 inches above the long-term average for March. It's also noted that Lake Michigan Huron is expected to rise about 2 inches by April 15th. But like I said, Sturgeon Bay and Green Bay right in front of my house seems very low. Birds are nesting, or it looks like they're at least resting and possibly nesting on small islands right off the shore of Sunset Park that last year were completely underwater. So I understand that it's complicated, but I can't help but wonder if the government data isn't maybe based on estimates that haven't been adjusted because of last year's incredibly dry year and then this winter's extreme lack of snow. But either way, we know it's complicated, and these fluctuations and the lack of consistent data have practical implications for communities around the Great Lakes. High water levels can lead to shoreline erosion, as we've seen recently, property damage, and flooding, impacting both natural and human-made environments. For gardeners, the variability in water levels combined with the changing precipitation patterns may necessitate adjustments in plant selection, garden location, and water management practices to mitigate the effects of both flooding and drought conditions. And this might be a move toward more, you know, native plants, more native, slightly more wild plants that are used to the changes in precipitation levels. And I'll get to that in just a little bit. So the rapid transition between extreme high and extreme low water levels are becoming the new normal for the Great Lakes region, And once again, this is driven by a mix of global climate variability and regional hydrological cycle components. This includes increased precipitation, potential periods of high evaporation, and unusual climate events like extreme cold air outbursts. Now, these factors put the region in uncharted territory with significant implications for water management, agriculture, and community planning. So I believe strongly in data. I like science. I like the scientists. I trust them. But sometimes, we have to look very carefully because, you know, it may be that these drastic changes are influencing estimates that are coming from reliable sources. I recently listened to a podcast episode of A Way to Garden, and the host, Ms. Roach, talked about how in the Northeast, where she lives, they are managing water in a very different way. They're having more and more of what they're calling extreme water events, which basically means that it storms and rains really, really hard for maybe 4 days, and then they don't get rain for quite a while. So they're talking about things like rain gardens, how to store water from rainstorms, and then also adjusting plants that they will put in their gardens. And we have to do some of that kind of stuff. Margaret Roach has a wonderful podcast, if you haven't heard about it, A Way to Garden, so you could check it out and then listen to what she talks about. She has great experts. She's been doing it for a long time. So adapting to these changes requires a comprehensive approach that considers the potential for both high and low water. And communities and individuals in the Great Lakes region, including us in Door County and along the Lake Michigan shoreline, need to incorporate flexibility and resilience into our plans and be prepared to make changes. The next issue is soil health and erosion, which is directly connected to precipitation and water levels. Extreme weather events, such as heavy rains, as described just a moment ago, and droughts or severe dry passages, like we've kind of gone through here in the Sturgeon Bay area at least, impact soil health, erosion, and garden sustainability. We gardeners must accept these challenges and implement complex strategies such as rain gardens and erosion control plants, especially native perennials. We need to limit, as much as possible, tilling, a common agricultural practice. It is a major contributor to soil erosion in the Midwest, and this leads to the loss of billions of tons of soil. This erosion not only reduces soil fertility, but also affects water quality and crop yields. Just a couple nights ago, I went to the presentation by Justin Croning from Stone Silo Prairie Gardening at Crossroads, and he talked a lot about the importance of natural landscaping and its benefits, like lower maintenance, less pesticides, less irrigation, less or no fertilizer, less invasive species, that's great for wildlife, and that it improves the soil. So if you didn't get a chance to get there, you can find out more information from Stone Silo Prairie Gardening. But the variability in water levels in Lake Michigan, with record highs and lows in recent years, as pointed out before, puts additional pressure on the shoreline, affecting both natural and human-made structures. And this has led to a lot of erosion, particularly in areas with bluffs, shorelines, and dunes. Now, for us, you know, we might not be able to control that other than, you know, through voting and trying to get native stuff back in, native plants back into those areas, but we can do things in our own gardens. So he listed quite a few strategies, and I also found some others through my research online that will combat soil erosion and improve garden sustainability. The first is using cover crops. Planting cover crops during off seasons reduces the time the soil is left bare, making it less vulnerable to erosion by wind and water. These crops also help improve soil health by adding organic matter. And if you can't plant cover crops, then you can put down natural organic compost, or, I mean, it doesn't have to be certified organic, but just compost that is healthy and it's going to break down and just feed the soil. But it covers the soil so you don't lose it to wind and sun and the extreme dry conditions. The second strategy is rain gardens. Creating rain gardens can help manage water runoff more effectively, reducing soil erosion and water pollution. They also provide habitat for local wildlife. So if your property, like mine, is on a slope, we slope down here at the end toward Little Lake and toward the bay, using some kind of rocks or building some kind of layers and terraces helps minimize the amount of water that flows down away from your plants. And it, when the water flows too fast, it pulls with it the soil. If you have plants with long tap roots or a big root structure, as Justin explained, even if those roots end up dying, they're going to be new plants that take their place and fill in those spaces. And he described to us how plants with long roots, they create like tunnels, like little channels that go down into the soil. And that those are some of the ways that water runs down more. So if you're not going to do native perennials, then we definitely want things that have long root structures. Like grass has a very shallow root structure, and therefore water will flow right over it. So the next strategy is erosion control plants, as we were just saying. Planting native vegetation, on, especially on vulnerable areas like slopes and dunes, helps stabilize the soil and reduce erosion. And deep-rooted plants hold the soil together, create those channels, and really do a lot for protecting the soil. As mentioned before, practice no-till farming. I have a tiller. I've used it a lot here. I've added, since we bought this place, 14, 15 garden beds in different sections. And I use the tiller a lot to break up the grass and get it out. And then I would put down cardboard and then put down mulch. I have some more plans for things, but I'm going to try really hard to stay away from the tiller. And I'm certainly not going to till anything else and just layer the soil as much as I possibly can. We mentioned terracing and contour farming. You can also do that in the garden. And especially on sloped lands, this reduces the runoff and soil erosion. Also planting buffer strips and windbreaks. My in-laws planted some nice big spruce near the front of our property. We get a lot of wind here right on the water, or very, very close to the water. So windbreaks reduce the wind speed and cuts down on erosion. And it keeps the nutrients in the soil. Addressing soil erosion requires both immediate action to prevent further degradation and then long-term strategies to rehabilitate damaged land and also just to maintain. We need to keep adding organic matter to our gardens so that it will build healthy soil and the plants will hold on and dig in. So that's a lot. Climate change is definitely affecting us, and there are a lot of issues, but that also means there's a lot that we can do, because most gardeners I know want, healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy environment. And so if we practice some of these strategies, not only are we improving our gardens, our yards, our land, but we're doing good things for our community and for the earth too. So just a quick wrap up. For the most part, if we embrace biodiversity by planting a variety of species that include drought-resistant native plants like coneflowers and things like that, it will be better off. If we mulch, it'll help conserve water and reduce erosion and suppress weeds. We didn't really talk much about pesticide use. I hope that everyone will at least consider not using pesticides, whether it's for mosquitoes or the bugs that are bothering us. If we can just do a little bit of research and try to find ways to combat those bugs within nature's system, long term, we'll be better off. And then anything else that we can think of to try to conserve water and protect the soil will be good. Now, next week, I'm going to have a couple of wonderful guests on the show. The presidents of the Door County Beekeepers Club will be joining me to talk about getting started in beekeeping, the beekeeping in Door County, the pros and cons, the things to look out for, and the club, the Door County Beekeepers Club. Mark and Max are wonderful guys. They're funny. They're helpful. They're exactly the kind of people that draw others to move to and settle in Door County. You'll really like them, I promise. So come back next week to hear that show. Please remember to check out the webpage, Door County Gardening. At the top, you'll see links to my Instagram account, Facebook, YouTube. The YouTube channel includes a feature on the Door County Master Gardeners plant sale, getting ready for that, and a slow tour through the garden door in March while it was still snowing a little bit, but it's still beautiful. So thanks again. Until next time.